The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Ni hao, and welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Jason Freeman. I'm a producer and editor here in the Author Events Office, and it's my pleasure to be here to introduce tonight's author. Frank Langfitt served as NPR's China correspondent for 5 years, reporting on such varied topics as the government's notorious detention centers and the Beijing Olympics, for which his team won the Edward R. Murrow Award for Sports Reporting. Currently NPR's London correspondent, he formerly served as that organization's East Africa correspondent, the Baltimore Sun's reporter in Beijing, and he got his start as a freelancer right here with the Philadelphia Inquirer. Mr. Langfitt's new book is called The Shanghai Free Taxi, Journeys with the Hustlers and Rebels of the New China. As NPR's correspondent in that bustling, emerging city, he created a free taxi service where he offered rides in exchange for passengers' stories and candid conversation. And candid it is. He met a motley crew of characters whose lives he followed for years as they navigated the sea change in Chinese economic and political life. And he got the idea for the free taxi while growing up outside of Philadelphia, where he spent his summers off from college, driving cabs and exploring his hometown. A recent review praises Shanghai Free Taxi thusly. It blends memorable characters with perceptive observation and informed political analysis to give readers a deep, nuanced look at the world's other superpower at this stage of its long, ongoing, rich history. Tonight, Mr. Langfitt will be joined in conversation with Bill Marimo, two-time Pulitzer Prize winner and former editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer. Since 2017, Mr. Marimo has been a vice president and editor at large for the Philadelphia Media Network. So let's hop in the cab and start the meter running as we welcome Frank Langfitt and Bill Marimo to the Free Library.
That was a great introduction, but I'm going to augment that introduction because I've known Frank very well since October 1986, when a young man from Narberth Cab wrote a letter to me and asked for a job at Mainline Neighbors of the Philadelphia Inquirer. I asked Frank what he'd written, and he suggested that I read his thesis from college, which was a masterful analysis of how Coca-Cola was trying to expand in Europe. We hired Frank. His first beat was writing obituaries that bring people to life and covering 7 suburban police departments, including my hometown, Haverford Township. After working in New Jersey with me, Frank was hired by the Lexington Herald Leader, which I consider a watershed in his career, because his first assignment was covering Hazard County, the easternmost county, a coal county, and a place that has no resemblance at all to an urban metropolis. Frank then came to the Baltimore Sun, where I was the metro editor and managing editor. And when he was assigned to Beijing, one of our top editors basically said there was no way he could do it. Frank, this would be walking off a cliff, said Tony Barbieri. The two people that had faith in Frank were me, because I'd seen what he could do in Haverford Township, and John Carroll, who'd been the editor of the Lexington Herald Leader and watched Frank perform miracles in Hazard County. So Frank has had really a classic journalistic career. I wanted to start out with a question, and that is, Frank, you went to Beijing the first time in the early 1990s, and you came back to Shanghai in a different era. And I'm interested in why did you decide to create a free taxi to learn how the countries had changed?
Well, thank you very much for the question, and also Andy and the Free Library, thanks for having me. This is a wonderful homecoming. I know I have a lot of friends from Episcopal Academy where I went to school. My brother David and my sister-in-law Margaret are in the audience. David's an attorney here in town, and just not so long ago wrote a great thriller of his own called Winnebo. So looking to see that republished here in Philadelphia. And it's just wonderful to be back and see folks. When I got to Beijing in 1997, the Chinese economy was perhaps the seventh or eighth largest in the world. And the economy was really beginning to take off, and we were beginning to see the boom. I came back about 10 years later. And I know many of you have probably been to China and you've seen some of these changes, but it's really remarkable. If you look at what Shanghai was like in 1990, that is the financial district across the river. It's called Lujiazui. And there, of course, 20 years later, a remarkable metropolis. And then, if you go to the right, this is what it looks like now. Those three buildings, just for some perspective, are taller than the Empire State Building. This was our neighborhood. My wife, Julie, and our kids, Katie and Christopher, we lived just a few blocks upriver from this area. But what I found when I came back, Bill, was that even amid all this great economic growth that had transformed lives, there were a lot of problems in China. One is there was terrible corruption, and the government, the Communist Party, was losing the faith of the Chinese people. People were essentially stealing not just tens of millions, but hundreds of millions of dollars from the government. And a lot of problems had not been addressed. The decade that I was away actually came to be known as the lost decade. So you had terrible pollution, as you can see here, and it wasn't improving. So even as people's sort of their living standards had improved dramatically, the quality of their life in some ways was going down. And I thought, what would be the best way to try to go at this? Well, I remembered as I had been a taxi driver here, and I decided to set up a free taxi service. And this idea really came working with my news assistant, whose name is Yang Zhuo. He's Chinese, was very, very helpful. And my wife, Julie, who's in the audience. We were trying to figure out how to actually do this because legally I couldn't drive as a foreigner. Unlike in Manhattan or in the United States, I couldn't drive as a foreigner in China. So we had to set up, Julie's idea was to set up these magnetic signs. And I actually, if you give me a moment, I might be able to show them to you. I brought a couple of them. So, and I'll just project if you don't mind. So this was one of the signs that we had made, and in Chinese it says, Mian Fei Ai Xing Che, which means loosely translated in English as free loving heart taxi. It sounds a lot better in Mandarin than it does in English. The second sign that was crucial to sending this message to possible passengers was this one on the back door. And this one says, Jiao Shanghai Peng Yo, Jiao Shanghai Sheng Huo, which is basically meet friends in Shanghai, chat about Shanghai life. So one evening, about 5 years ago, I went out on a rainy Saturday night and went out hunting for passengers. And my hope was at this great moment in Chinese contemporary history where it was clear there was an inflection point, the country was going to be heading in some direction, try to learn from ordinary people, from their perspective, what they wanted out of the country, where they thought it was heading, and that's how I began.
Frank, one logical question that occurs to me is, given the nature of surveillance in China, what prompted people to open up?
I think that what I found when I used to drive for Narberth and Kenwood Cab here, and I'd grown up in outside of Philadelphia, but I wouldn't say, like most of us, I lived in a circumscribed area. I didn't know much of the city, and I found when I got in the cab and I was driving people around the suburbs and then into the city, I ended up meeting all kinds of people I never would have met, and they took me to all kinds of parts of the city that I never would have gone to. And what I found also is in a taxi cab, they felt like they weren't likely to see me again. So they were often very candid about what was going on in their lives. And I was in the front seat. There was just a little bit of eye contact through the rearview mirror. And I found that was a really nice, safe space to talk. Well, that's exactly kind of what you needed in China at this moment. People are very concerned, more and more so, about what they say. And so the cab was a place to just sort of chat about what was going on in life and allow them to sort of talk about what they found most interesting. And then I began to focus on the most interesting characters and people that I met through the cab.
Frank, to what extent were you or the passengers worried about the possibility of eavesdropping or surveillance in the cab or later as you developed the relationships in your conversations?
Yeah, so it's interesting. As long as you don't cross a political line, and it's not always clear where that is, most of the surveillance tends to happen around politically sensitive events. So I would cover political demonstrations, which are banned in China. But it was usually when I would be doing those sorts of things that I felt I needed to be careful. I did have a bug sweeper that I'd used in the office, so I was able to make sure if there were bugs, there was no evidence that the cab was bugged. And then after I met them in the cab and we would record things, once I got to know people and I began to sort of shuttle them back and forth, the folks that I found most interesting, shuttle them back and forth to work, things along those lines, then I would end up being invited into their homes and things like that. That was not so great a concern. It is a little bit of a concern now. In writing the book, I only used first names for the most part. I used English names because even though this is not intended as a political book, a lot happened between 2014 when I started to do this and today. I mean, the United States and China are in the midst of a trade war. The United States is now far more repressed. I mean, China is far more repressive than it was when I started this project. So I'm a little more concerned now about people's security than I was starting off.
One of the scenes that was indelible when I read the book was your trip to the rural parts of China. And there was one town, I'd urge you guys to get the book and read about this, one town where you were the first foreigner to ever appear in that town. I'd really like to hear about that experience.
Sure. So after about a year of driving around Shanghai, of course, Shanghai is about as representative of China as Manhattan is of the United States. You need definitely to get out of town and talk to different sorts of people. So what we ended up doing is putting an advertisement out on Weibo, which is the Chinese equivalent of Twitter, offering a free ride home for Chinese New Year, which is the largest annual mass migration in the world. And we ended up, I think, these are just a couple of the few of the people that I got to meet as I was driving, and we'd often take selfies. But what we ended up doing was this Chinese New Year's road trip, and I met Rocky and Charles. Rocky's to my left. He chose his English name for Rocky Balboa, which is very appropriate if you're Chinese because getting ahead, there's lots of opportunity, but it is also a very tough struggle for a lot of folks. And then there is Charles on the right, and they both were very interesting. They were white-collar migrants. I had done this trip 20 years earlier, and the people that I had traveled with were more working class. But we ended up going deep into the countryside, and this is actually Rocky's village. And as you can see, these are fallow fields. Most people have left the village and moved to the cities. And I got to be a wedding chauffeur because both of these men were getting married to different women. And so I drove around and drove folks to the wedding. And there you can see part of the wedding party. What was really interesting is China is, I thought by 2015, most people in the country would have met a foreigner, but that's not true. A lot of these villages still are very remote. And I remember when I came to this village and I met Rocky's mother, who's a wonderful person and incredibly resilient, suffered a great deal during the Cultural Revolution, she was chatting with me and her phone rang and she answered and it was very funny. She was speaking in the local dialect, so I didn't understand. But the only thing I could pick up in Mandarin was, there's a foreign reporter interviewing me right now. And suddenly Rocky's, within 5 minutes, Rocky's aunties were coming up the muddy trail to meet me. And it was hilarious. And I was, of course, shaking hands with all of them. And they would all laugh and cover their mouths. But it was wonderful. And then I was sort of pretty easily accepted because I'd driven down with Rocky. And we'd gotten to know each other on this 500-mile drive to the village. But yeah, there's still a lot of villages in China where people have not met foreigners.
How far is that village from Shanghai?
It was about a 12-hour drive. I was very tired at the end, and driving in China is not easy.
Speaking about driving, Frank, there's a very dramatic scene in the book where you're riding on a narrow road and in the country, and a truck is blocking your path, and you're trying to navigate around the truck or in the brink of a precipice. Talk about that. actually talk about what it tells us about the Chinese.
Well, this was Charles's village. He had actually decided, he said, I'd really like you to see how rural life operates here. So he wanted me to come to his ancestral village for a pig slaughter, which was tough to watch because I grew up in Marion. And I'm not used to that. But I tried to appear tough, which I didn't do a very good job on that. And then on the way out of town that afternoon, it's a very narrow road, a dirt road, that was on the edge of terraced rice fields. So it was a good 6-foot drop. And there are no guardrails, of course. This is, you know, rural China. And the man on the other side wouldn't move. And I backed up, and then actually the back wheel of the van went off the road, and the van tipped to one side. And I was just thinking, how am I going to ever explain to my editors back at NPR that I rolled a van in the Chinese countryside? Fortunately, we were able to get it back on the road, but the man still would not move. And finally, I lost my temper, and I yelled at him and got out of the car, and he eventually moved back. But one of the lessons of that is that in particularly outside of the major cities, there is not a great sense of embedded rights that people have towards each other, particularly in rural China, but also in smaller cities. And one of the arguments you will hear from many Chinese themselves is that the idea of taking a Western democratic model and imposing it on China makes very, very little sense, because people have not grown up with a lot of with the kind of system of governance you have here, the civics that you're taught in elementary school, that sort of thing. And so this was a reminder, while I've been dazzled by Shanghai and very sophisticated people I'd met there, it was a reminder of how long it will take a country like China, 1.4 billion people, to come along and make that kind of progress.
One assertion that you made in the book, and that you also showed, was that many Chinese trust Americans and other foreigners more than they trust their countrymen. Tell us about that.
This was an interesting thing with the cab. So when I started driving the cab, I didn't know what was going to happen. I didn't know if anyone would get in the cab. I didn't know how those conversations would go. And I remember a moment at a Shanghai ferry stop just near our apartment building where two young factory workers wanted to be taken to the Pearl Tower, one of the tourist attractions in the city, and they were very hesitant to get in the cab. And one of the ferry workers, who I'd been chatting with for a while that day, said, no, it's okay, he's a foreign friend. You don't have to worry, it's okay. There's great distrust on the streets of China for a variety of reasons, some of them historical, going back to at least the Cultural Revolution, where families were pitted against each other for political reasons. But it's also the shift to market capitalism from socialism was very swift. There's not free access to religion and other things that would kind of help temper the way people treat each other. And so there's a lot of trickery and distrust, and the fact that I was not local Chinese actually made people more likely to get, and people told me this. They said, had you been Chinese, I actually would not have gotten in the cab. But I was willing to because, felt that I was probably a bit different.
Another fact that I learned from reading the book was about what I'll call the fragility of people's economic status. The fact that someone like the barber became relatively middle class or upper middle class and then lost it all without any premonition. Tell us about that.
Sure. I think one of the things that I came away with, and I guess I knew this to some extent, but getting to know a variety of these passengers, and just to put this in some perspective, I probably drove dozens and dozens, maybe 80 or 90 people, but I ended up focusing on a series of folks that I got to know, and then I followed their lives for the next 4 or 5 years, not just in China, but some of them moved around the world. And one thing that they all had in common is their lives were vastly better materially than their parents. Many of them, to varying degrees, were living the American dream in China, and that was an extremely positive thing. And I also want to emphasize that many of them were quite supportive of the Communist Party, because some of them, the younger ones, and they're 25, 30 years old, all they had known was 6% GDP growth year on year, which means there's no generation like them in any country in human history. There's nothing like that has happened. So you can understand why they would be supportive. At the same time, it was a precarious existence. And one of these folks that I got to know, who I liked very much, and I think you guys would like very much as well, was a barber from a small village, and he had very hardworking, had come to Shanghai with nothing. His first night he slept on the Bund, looking out over those buildings that I just showed you earlier. And he ended up building up a very big business. He had a penthouse salon that he had built, but he was very unsophisticated. He had an eighth grade education. He did not know much about finance. I was very worried about him, and he ended up being swindled by someone that he gave his money to, who was a loan shark, who was giving him 20% returns. There's another character, another person I met in the book, who also, there were a lot of Ponzi schemes. So a lot of people would make money, and of course they wanted to make more, but they weren't very sophisticated, and they would give their money to what turned out to be massive, massive Ponzi schemes, and you would have 25,000, 50,000 people wiped out of billions and billions of dollars. So there have been great progress economically, but it's also, it can be precarious, and it can disappear pretty quickly if you're not careful.
Frank, I'm interested in the what I'll call the big brother aspect
Sure.
of life in China. And I'd be interested in having you talk about the emergence and sophistication of surveillance cameras in public and private places.
Yeah, so when my wife and I first got to China in 1997, there were some cameras, but you paid no attention to them. When we returned in 2011, if you would come to intersections in Shanghai, you could see 15 cameras, traffic cameras, across an intersection. And they're working very, very hard on facial recognition. There's a corner of a park that I think most Chinese don't even know exists, but there's a corner of a park in Shanghai where there actually is free political speech. And I've gone there and watched older people debate about the Communist Party in ways that are almost unimaginable. It's tolerated. Many of them suffered during the Civil War. They were on the wrong side of that loss and the takeover of the communists. I used to go there on Sunday afternoons, and for a long time there was maybe a camera or two. I was just back there last year, and there were five separate video cameras. And they were the kind that are very sophisticated that can pivot and focus. And it was really striking because here are a bunch of old people who are really no threat to the regime at all. And yet, they had spent a lot of money to keep an eye on them.
So as far as I know, and correct me if I'm wrong, there's no Chinese consulate here in Philadelphia. Am I right about that, audience? Thank you. So Frank has been on a book tour in several cities where there are Chinese consulates. And I'd like you, Frank, to tell us what's happened.
Yeah, so my first event was in Chatham House, the think tank in London, and Chatham House gave me a list of everyone who was coming so you could see a sense of what the audience was like. And then about midway through the Q&A, somebody in the back who had slipped in without registering, had just done a walk-in off the street, introduced him as a counselor at the Chinese embassy. And I got to say, the temperature of the room dropped a few degrees. And he asked some questions and then came up and talked to me afterwards. I was in San Francisco yesterday, and there were two people from the Chinese consulate there. And, there's a sense you have these days, and I don't think this would have happened as much 5-6 years ago, that the Chinese government is watching what people are saying, not just in China, but they're watching what people are saying and what the kinds of work they're producing overseas. And they're a much greater presence. And so it's interesting to find yourself in the United States and being aware that the people who, members of the government that used to harass you and sometimes surveil you in China are kind of keeping an eye on you back here in your homeland.
Frank, to what extent are the people that you've described in the book concerned about adverse consequences?
I think that they're fine for now. I think that I've done everything I can to hide their identities. There are no photos in the book. I have lots of great photos. There's no point in doing photos in the book. The people that you see here have all approved the photos that I'm showing you. I've kept photos offline. I am having trouble getting the book to the people who are in the book. So it's difficult. In order to send some documents, you need to use a virtual private network to get around the Great Firewall, which prevents the people in China from accessing banned websites. Some of the people that I know who are in the book do not have VPNs, as they're called, so they can't access the book. I am finding ways to physically get the book to people, and some of that means handing it off to other people to get that book into the country. If you go on Amazon right now, you will see that it is not available in China. It's blocked, and that happens a lot these days. the tolerance for this kind of writing, and again, it's not a political book, is very, very low under Xi Jinping.
So before we start questions from the audience, Frank, I have two more for
sure.
you. First of all, seeing that your editor, Connie Langland, from Mainline Neighbors is here, what tools of the trade did you learn back in 1986 and 87 that you applied to writing this book, reporting and writing the book?
How much time do you have? So one of the great opportunities for me was out of college when I got hired by Bill, and he paid me. I remember the conversation because Connie was there as well. And Bill basically said, I'll give you a story. I'll pay you $50. If you do a good job, you get another story. And that was it. And so you had to really perform. The other thing I learned, particularly from Bill, which I really thought about all the time and as I was finally fact-checking this book, is to go back to all the folks and read them everything back to make sure I got every fact correct. And I spent hours on the phone reading parts of the book. I even sent text to people just to make sure that everything was accurate. And also, if there was anything sensitive, anything that they thought might identify them, that they could ask me to remove it. And so I think that was a big thing that I learned over 30 years ago that I absolutely applied to this. The other thing is that I think journalism is really about relationships. It's often we're working on deadline and we're trying to extract information and get something into the paper or on All Things Considered. And here, especially in this was about relationships. All of these people now, to varying degrees, are friends of mine. I've been in their homes. I've given speeches at their weddings. And to also, as Bill said, when I remember working with him in the Inquirer, treat everybody the way you would want a reporter to treat your own family members. And I think that's a great way to approach journalism, to think, be as humane as possible, and think about the potential consequences for them when they're being so willing to open themselves up and be so honest about their own lives.
My last question. You have a great wife and two children, Julie, Christopher, and Katie. They have been all over the world while you've been working. How do they do it?
Well, I think the answer to this, we've worked in East Africa, we've worked in China twice, we're now in London, and I would say the key to this is marry the right woman and be fortunate enough to have the sort of children that we do. Katie and Christopher are extremely adventurous, and Julie's a risk taker. When the opportunity to go to Beijing came up in 1997, I came home in Washington that night and just mentioned it. And Julie's first response to it, that the bureau was open, was China. I'd go to China. And I said, really? And so we got out an atlas. We're not very sophisticated. And we got out an atlas and we saw, oh, Thailand is very close to China. Vacations in Thailand would be great. And then we sort of went from there, and I was very surprised to actually get the job. I was shocked and terrified, but I got on a plane sight unseen in April of 1997, and that was the beginning of all of this.
All right, we're now going to open it up to questions. Julie.
Oh, my gosh.
Frank, could you tell the audience about how Charles found his wife? Or was it?
Charles was... Charles had a really tough story, and I do hope you read about him, because while we talk about the great opportunities in China and the great economic growth, it is hard-earned if you're a migrant. You really are a second-class citizen. And Charles traveled all over the country working very difficult jobs, one of which he actually, for a day or two, was turned into literally an ox. He was given a plow and a rope and had to plow soil and plant seeds when he had been told it was a job, he's going to be a salesman. But Charles met his wife, and he was struggling to find somebody. He was home for Chinese New Year, and he was on WeChat, which is the ubiquitous social media app in China. And he and his wife, who at that time was just living 5 miles away, you could shake your phone, and it would show you who was nearby. And Charles and his wife didn't know each other, of course, shake their phone at the exact same time, and their pictures popped up, and they started chatting on WeChat. And that was the beginning of their relationship.
I wanted to ask you to do some economic analysis. I know you've been in East Africa as well as China. My son spent almost a year in Rwanda working for a nonprofit and was amazed at the economic growth there in East Africa. And China, of course, has outstripped it, but both economies, of course, have lots of problems with graft and trying to keep that. So I was wondering if you could give some idea about directions and what that may tell us about both parts of the world.
Well, it's interesting because I remember being in East Africa and having not been back to China in quite some time and struck by the sort of systemic graft that you would deal with. I'd never made eye contact with cops when I was driving in Nairobi because I knew they would try to pull me over and shake me down. When I got back to China in 2011, I didn't deal with the graft directly. People were just stealing at pathological levels. I mean, enormous amounts of money. They were spearing it out of the country, billions upon billions of dollars. What Xi Jinping came in and did, which was extremely shrewd and very effective, is he ran the toughest anti-corruption campaign in the history of the Communist Party. And he's put more than 1 million people in jail. And even my liberal friends, when he was doing this, who didn't like Xi's politics, were very, very grateful. And I think that was a turning point in saving the regime. Because what I saw, it was going in absolutely the wrong direction for the party. And that's been very, very helpful. There are times, though, that people are so now terrified of being targeted. And some of this targeting is Xi has not only thrown lots of officials in jail, he's also thrown his rivals in jail. It's been both a political exercise and a legal exercise. It's now very hard to get things done sometimes because people are afraid to do any projects. They're afraid that they'll be turned in. So there are a lot of things that can't get done in China. I have not been to Nairobi in a long time. I think one of the frustrating things in a place like Kenya and elsewhere is there is heavy corruption and it really slows down development. And one of the great things in China was to watch the country just transformed. Even though there was quite a bit of corruption, it wasn't as crippling as it was in East Africa.
What were some of your experiences with the Chinese, you know, secret the police or whatever services that you interacted with?
So many. So I would say maybe 1999. This was an amazing story, and we just sort of fell into it. I was working in the office on a Sunday and got a phone call from farmers in a small village in southern China, and they said there'd been a massacre in the village by the People's Armed Police. The whole point of the People's Armed Police is they were riot police to avoid the repetition of what had happened in Tiananmen Square, which is bringing in the army, which is not at all appropriate to deal with civil unrest. And they killed a few people, and we ended up calling all these different farmers. We were able to find phone numbers and verify what had happened and did a story on it. And then a couple of days, so it got the story out and then got on an airplane to go down and then try to visit the village and see what had happened. And I got off the jetway. And I was greeted by two people from the foreign ministry who said, "Mr. Langford, so nice to see you." And they took me into a hotel room and interrogated me for 3 hours. And what was really interesting is they had no idea how I'd figured this out. And some of them, it was clear, didn't really even know the story themselves, because I had actually gone to a press conference earlier and asked the government spokesperson about this, and she was shocked. So it wasn't something that people knew. That was clear that they were listening to our phones and we made a mistake. There was another time, by the late 90s, it was also clear that the government in China, as the NSA can do here, can triangulate your cell phone signal. They also, if you turn it off, they can turn it on and use it as a listening device. And I was in Shenzhen, which is a giant city right on the mainland border across from Hong Kong, and I left an interview, and I was driving along a highway in the back of a taxi, and the taxi driver said, "There are two guys behind us in this car, and they've been tailing us for 3 or 4 miles. And I said, "Lose them." So he took off, and we're doing 60, 70 miles an hour across these highways through Shenzhen. We're riding the ramps to lose this car, and it had tinted windows, that sort of thing. It was very clear that the guy at the wheel of this car was highly trained. We couldn't possibly lose him. And so finally, I said, "Well, I got to go to work." We cannot drive all over Shenzhen trying to lose this guy. So we pulled over, and I went up, and I did a series of interviews, and I got the phone numbers of everyone I talked to. And the people who were tailing me did pull up near us, got out of the car, and they were from Central Casting. wraparound black shades, the earpiece, bald head. I mean, it was hilarious. And their job, they were like the B team. We always saw them. That's the B team. The B team wants you to know that they're there. They want to intimidate you. They want to just see if you'll spook or do something. The A team is the bigger problem. They're the ones that you don't know that are there. And they're the ones that are really dangerous. And I've seen people, there was a time during demonstrations in Tiananmen Square that the Australian Broadcasting were using their phone saying, okay, we're going to go down and do this just to see how the A team would respond. They were up on the 15th floor of a building on the biggest boulevard in Beijing. And as they made these phone calls, they then looked out the balcony and they could see people coming into position on the street. So lots of stories. I can tell you more afterwards.
Hi, I was wondering if you could speak to two things. One, did you learn anything about the education system? And number two, can you comment on any safety of intellectual property?
So on the educational system, one of the people that I drove had been a teacher, and her name is Fifi. And she described to me what it was like trying to teach critical thinking in a system where critical thinking was a threat to the longevity of the regime. And she described in the late 90s and early 2000s that she would try to teach about what had happened in Tiananmen Square in 1989. And over time, initially students would be interested, but later generations were really mostly focused on trying to get the best, highest test scores. And they weren't interested, and there was this reversal where the older person was much more oriented towards trying to seek out the truth, and the younger people were much more pragmatic. And she found it very frustrating. Also, she was forced often to teach Communist Party gobbledygook to them. And she eventually left and became a psychologist. I also got to know some of the people that she had worked with, and they told me that part of the, you know, it's a very stressful environment in a big city like Shanghai. It's very hard to get on the housing ladder. It's hard to get a good education because it's so competitive. And she felt, one of the people that I talked to, felt that this was partly by design to keep young people so consumed with just competition that they wouldn't have time to think of some different way to organize the country and in terms of the government. Then on intellectual property rights, the good news on IPR is that at the sort of general court level, it's much better now. Chinese companies are creating IPR. They want it defended just like any other company. And so a lot of those cases are adjudicated in a pretty reasonable way. The problem, though, is when it comes to sensitive industries that the Chinese government really wants to dominate, many companies, I think particularly multinationals, still are very, very frustrated. I think if you go back a year or two ago, the Shanghai American Chamber of Commerce in Shanghai, the number one issue of concern was protecting IPR. This is after 25 years of stories of people having their IPR stolen, either by partners who they couldn't really sue with any success, and we've seen more recently, in recent years, cyber espionage.
You had indicated that you talked to a lot of these people in the cab, and I'm assuming that a lot of it was in Mandarin.
Mm-hmm.
But what percentage of these people you got to go around with a number of times also spoke English? Because when we were there, especially in the larger cities, even though the percentage wasn't great, there still were a lot of people that spoke English.
Yeah, this
and
is a
second part.
Sure.
If you send a book over there, I'm assuming you're sending it in English.
Oh, yeah.
And
good luck getting it translated.
The person getting it will either need help or you think will be able to read it.
You mean the people that I know? The people who are in the book.
Right.
So there's been a dramatic change. In the 1990s in Beijing, I never spoke English because most people didn't speak English at all. A few of our friends did. By Shanghai now, there are lots of young people who speak a lot of English. The initial conversations in the free taxi cab were in Mandarin, but over time, some of the people did speak English quite well, and I got to say that was a lifesaver because I have over 200 hours of recorded conversations, and transcribing that from translating it from Chinese to English, and that it would have been, this book would have taken a lot longer. So a lot of these conversations, particularly with some of the more sophisticated, well-educated people were in English, it was a great shortcut. In terms of sending it back there, Some of them can read quite well, and they've already read parts of the book. Others will not be able to read it, and I don't know how I will be able to communicate the book to them. I've talked to them in Mandarin, so they know their section of the book. They know what I say, and they're fine with that. And then in terms of publishing, I don't see a future for, under this regime, I don't see a likelihood, a future for this book in Mandarin in the mainland. It could be translated into more traditional characters in Taiwan and Hong Kong. That's a possibility. One friend of mine who wrote a book called One Child, a very interesting book, Mei Fong, a journalist who used to work for the Wall Street Journal, she translated it into Mandarin and gave it away on the mainland. And so there are lots of ways to approach this. So we'll see.
I was curious about your opinion of Alipay and China's move towards cashless currency. And do you think that that coming to the U.S. eventually could be scary, potentially?
On the second part of your question, I'm not well informed enough in terms of it being a scary thing or a risk. What I have seen in China is there's this leapfrogging effect. So people didn't have they had maybe some landlines. It was hard to get a landline. Most people leapfrogged landlines and went straight to cell phones. So in terms of a cashless society, to give you an example, 3 years ago in a market, I would be using cash to buy fruit. When I was back the last time, everybody was just swiping their phones, buying fruit in rural markets. So it has become incredibly cashless. And it's actually a little frustrating if you're a foreigner, because I no longer live there. I don't have a Chinese bank account. I wasn't able to actually get taxis. It was very frustrating. I was kind of cut out. But it's incredibly efficient, that form. And in terms of the future of what Alipay might mean for security and financial security in the United States, I don't know. Those are kind of businesses that really, and Alibaba has a lot of experience with this, they rely fundamentally on trust. And they can't afford to have anyone distrusting them with their money, whether it's in mainland China or beyond. That's something I would have a fair bit of faith in Jack Ma and Alibaba on that one. If we could have my brother David, who's there.
Fire away, David.
Frank, I'd like you to share with people any example of a person you knew or knew about who disappeared in China and never reappeared again.
Do you mean from this story, from this book?
You can use something from the story or anything else
Sure.
that you think is interesting.
Well, so one of the things about this project was you never knew where it was going, and I mostly followed the stories and the passengers and the people I got to know where they took me. So after about a year or so, after I had done worked as a wedding chauffeur in the villages, I got a note on LinkedIn from a Chinese-American NPR lister who lived in Michigan. And she said, I've heard your stories, and I think you can help me. My little sister has gone missing in the mountains of Yunnan province, and I was wondering if you come and help me hunt for her. And Yunnan is right on the border with Laos and Thailand. And so a few weeks later, I actually flew down there, got a four-wheel drive SUV, and we went off searching for this woman who had disappeared. Now, the more we delved into her life, the more we learned about this sister. And she had worked as a prostitute in northeastern China and a mistress. This was not uncommon for, while many of the people in the book and many Chinese have done very well economically, not everyone is competitive. And so there are a lot of younger women coming out of the provinces who go into sex work. And she had moved down to Yunnan province to try to turn her life around and become a businesswoman, not an uncommon transition that people try to make, but she had not been successful. And she had ended up in a relationship with a married man. There was a case of blackmail. And it just proceeded to get darker and darker the deeper we got into the story. I was working with the bigger sister who was from Michigan. And finally, in the end, we had to sort of stop investigating because it was becoming dangerous. And I thought, you know, what are the lessons of this story? One is it, in some sense, it's universal. It's a tale of siblings who go in different directions. But it was also particular to China because if you took these two women and they had been born in an earlier era under real socialism, they wouldn't have traveled much, they wouldn't have had opportunities to pursue careers, and they probably would have had very similar circumscribed lives. But market capitalism gave them the opportunity to pursue, you know, much more ambitious lives. One of them had been very competitive, became a nurse, and moved to the United States. But the other one had to basically get involved in an illicit trade to try to live out her dream, and it ended, as far as we could tell, quite badly. So that's I think a very interesting chapter, and also an interesting couple of chapters, and also an example of what I found most interesting about this opportunity. Was you didn't know where these stories were going, and you felt like you were learning as the people you were working with were learning as well.
Years ago, I read a book about the Soviet era underworld and its transformation in the 90s. Now, Philadelphia has a thriving heroin trade. Mm. It's visible if you walk around in Center City. The addicts are panhandling everywhere. Is there a heroin underworld or anything like a drug underworld in Shanghai?
There is. It's not as evident or pronounced as it is in the United States right now. Down in Yunnan province, it also so happens that the barber that I mentioned earlier that Bill was asking about, the one who had built this salon business, he had grown up in what's called the Golden Triangle, which is also where this woman disappeared. Now, the Golden Triangle, as most of you know, is one of the biggest opium-growing areas in the world. And this fella, this Max, this salon owner, this was back in, probably would have been the 1980s, early 1990s. His friends were shooting up and dying in bathrooms in Yunnan province back then. And his brother saw Max heading in the same direction, his older brother, and he said, you have to leave. You've got to leave the town, you got to leave the province, you need to go out and make something of yourself. And that's what Max did. Even though he didn't want to leave, and it was very, very painful. There is a drug trade. There's a lot of drugs that also will come in from Central Asia. But having, I come in and out of the United States, I'm very struck by what you describe as well. I saw that in New York and also San Francisco, where I just was. So it's a drug problem, but not as pronounced as we see it here in the United States. At least it's not as visually evident to me as it is here in the U.S.
Well, were you able to talk about with any of the people whom you drove around the current political situation here and what
yes.
they have opinions?
Yeah.
I'd like to know what they
That's a
think.
Really, that's a great question. And that's actually a part of the second half of the book is people making sense of what's happened in the United States. If you went back to 1989 and Tiananmen Square, there was the United States was held in great regard by the protesters in Tiananmen. And over time, though, some of the policy decisions by the U.S. government, whether it be the Iraq War, the global financial crisis, has eroded American standing in China among ordinary Chinese. The election of Donald Trump was not very popular among a lot of Chinese. And there's a woman that I got to know who's in the book named Ashley, who comes to America. She comes to America looking for freedom and opportunity and wants to get away from censorship, and 5 months later President Trump is elected, and she becomes, you know, pretty disappointed. And then she watched what happens in Charlottesville, and this woman and I have been having rolling conversations because she's been moving around the world. I've talked to her in Paris, London, Chicago, and also in China. We've had these rolling conversations as she tries to make sense of what is the best system for China. And she became pretty disillusioned with the United States and started talking more about the effectiveness and efficiency of the authoritarian system in China. So if you do get the book, I recommend you read her point of view, because I think it's fascinating to see how what's been happening in the United States does affect people's view of democracy writ large.
Since we're only going to have one more question, I'm going to take the interviewer's prerogative and ask it myself. So at the end of your book, Frank, you write quite eloquently about China's midlife crisis.
Hmm.
And would you tell us about that as a finale?
Yeah, I think that the country has gone through now 40 years of rapid economic change and social change. And one of the things that struck me over the last 20 years getting to know Chinese people is they are exhausted. Things have changed so quickly. They don't have the institutions, whether it's religious or community institutions or government institutions, to help them deal and grapple with all this change. The competition is intense. I know many Americans look at Chinese and will complain that they've been stealing our jobs. The truth of the matter is multinational corporations exported American jobs to China, and very hardworking Chinese took them and did them very well. But I've noticed there's a particular person named in this book named Ray, who's a lawyer, and he has gone from being a farm boy to being a lawyer in one generation. It's a dramatic change. But in our conversations, our recent conversations, and also when I was in China, he's completely stressed out. He's like any lawyer in any American big city. And he's really spent, and what's interesting is he's looking very much, he's already, since he now has the comforts of a middle or upper middle class life, he travels to Italy with his child, that sort of thing, which would have been unthinkable for his parents' generation. He's looking for ways to give back. He's looking for a richer, more spiritual, more meaningful life. And so what you've seen is, things have happened so fast in China that a single person can go from, you know, subsistence farmer to now wanting to write and teach and contribute to society in just 40 years. But it has been a very tiring existence for many of these people.
Well, Frank, thank you, and thank the audience for your receptivity.
Yeah, great questions.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.